Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. America, and all the chips in the PC. It is Saturday, the 19th of May, Anno Domini 2018, and you, you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Benright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 5 minutes after the hour, we're going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose, nothing to lose. Don't get the blues. Kick off your shoes. Here comes the news. Before we do the news, because I didn't have this as a story because I looked for it and missed it. I don't know. But I do want to congratulate Tom Golisano and Mark Murphy for getting the okay for Mr. Golisano to acquire Greenlight Networks. And I want to congratulate everybody in Rochester for that. So we'll see. So that's a very nice thing. But on to the news of the day. That's going to be big, and we'll see what we can do about that. But right now we have other things to talk about. It may have gotten lost in the shuffle of all the Android P news at Google's I.O. conference last week. But fear not, dear friends. Chrome OS has definitely not been forgotten. Google's been making steady progress in advancing its Chrome operating system over the last several months, particularly around its efforts to further align Android and Chrome OS and turn Chromebooks into an all-purpose productivity machine and Android tablet replacement. Practically every week, in fact, there's some new and noteworthy feature being added to the platform. And though it wasn't in the keynote, a massive new development did sneak its way into Chrome OS during I.O. The quietly announced ability for Chromebooks to run Linux apps as if they were native applications without the need for any complex and security-defeating configurations. Linux app support is on its way to the Pixelbook to start, currently in that device's developer channel and likely becoming available much more broadly before long, and then it'll work its way down to any number of other Chromebooks, certainly not all of them, particularly a lot of the low-end or early ones, but it should happen. Well, and of course, Linux apps, you're probably thinking, yawn. What's next? Support for OS 2 programs? That's for both of us who loved and remember OS 2 programs. Before you write this off as being no big deal, though, hang on. Linux app support comes to Chrome OS. That's actually a monumental move for the platform for two main reasons. It's yet another but checked off the column of but Chromebooks can't. At this point, Chromebooks can run traditional Chrome and web apps, and they can run Android apps, a similarly transformational capability, only on a much more universally impactful scale. For the vast majority of computer users, that combination alone is enough to cover everyone. But, of course, there are obviously plenty of exceptions, but it's true that for a huge chunk of the computer-using public, that's all you need. But then there's a group of people who often say, I can almost get by on a Chromebook, except for, and that's precisely the group for whom the new Linux app support could be significant. For example, I can get by with a Chromebook except for Photoshop. Well, now you've got the GIMP, the new image manipulation program.
And half a dozen other shareware.
And half a dozen other programs that do the same thing. And you can now run Skype, and you can run all kinds of things. I should be able to run Second Life on it. It opens up the world. It also opens up the world of Chrome OS to Android developers. Seriously, you cannot underestimate the importance of this. By bringing Linux app support to Chrome OS, Google is allowing developers to run code editors, including Google's own official Android Studio development tool, by the way, on Chromebook devices. Up till now, there was no great way to accomplish that. Remember, Google is positioning Chromebooks to take over the role of the Android tablet. While most Android apps can run on Chromebooks just fine out of the box without any major extra effort, the experience tends to be noticeably nicer when a developer takes the time to optimize an app for that environment and make sure it's taking full advantage of the larger screen and keyboard-assisted interface. And if Android developers can actually use Chromebooks to do their work, well, they seem much more likely, at least in theory, to develop their apps with Chromebooks in mind. Understanding the significance of Google's Chrome OS progression is all about seeing the forest for the trees. This is yet another seemingly small piece in a much bigger puzzle, something that may seem shrug-worthy on the surface, but that along with other incoming pieces adds up to an increasingly intriguing whole. So our poll of the week at soundbites.org, that is Bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, is Linux apps on Chromebooks. Your choices are can't wait, meh, I don't get it, and but Steve Jobs. So far there's 23 votes and can't wait is over 50% of them. But I know you're going to have more to say, so if you scroll down on the right, under Fascinating Stuff, you will see the forums. The second forum down is the poll discussion. And currently, at least the first item in the poll discussion is 19 May 18, Linux apps on Chromebook. We've got four posts there already, so please join us and have something to say about that. And then, of course, you can always give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415.
Yeah, you're right. If Steve Jobs were alive, he would never have done this.
He would never have done this. But you know what? I don't think you can underestimate, particularly in the education market, the advantage of being able to run Chrome apps, Android apps, and Linux programs all on a semi-inexpensive device with a keyboard.
And it almost already does that with the Macintosh, because it is Unix already.
Right.
You got the Mac OS, and you can run VMs to do Windows and other OSs.
That's exactly right, but it's not inexpensive. And that's the problem schools have.
Yeah.
You know, if I can buy three Chromebooks for the price of one Mac, which one am I going to get? You know, yep. And it's an interesting problem that schools have had to handle for decades, and I get that. But we're very very excited about this. It's I'm sure we'll be talking about it a lot at Rochester Google's in a couple weeks. But it's Google is clearly very invested in the Chromebook, and we're already seeing schools buying massive numbers of Chromebooks. In lieu of things like iPads.
Mm-hmm.
And that's mainly because of the keyboard.
Yeah.
You know, if you can buy a Chromebook with a keyboard for less than you can buy an iPad with a keyboard, people are very, very excited about that.
Well, like you were saying, whether you can buy, say, 2-to-1,
right.
Even a 2-to-1 ratio,
right.
That's still saving the school systems a lot of money.
Right. And in fact, Microsoft has suddenly woken up to this fact. And they're talking now about selling their Surface tablets for less than the cost of an iPad.
Mm-hmm.
Not their high-end models, but a lower-end model. And again, you can add a keyboard to it, but now that's still going to bring the cost higher than a Chromebook. And if you're a school administrator, you're going to go to the people making the decision and say, why did you buy these instead of Chromebooks when we could buy, you know, even if it's 1.5-to-1?
Well, like we've pointed out before, I mean, yeah, I buy a bunch of, you know, the iPads. Then I got to worry about viruses, spyware, updates, and everything else that you got to keep track of.
Right.
A Chromebook, you can schedule it to do it, you know, at night.
Right.
And it doesn't get the viruses, spyware. You're not paying for an operating system.
Right. Well, it's the big thing is it's cheaper. iPads are pretty good about viruses. Right now, still the king is Chromebooks in terms of virus proof. And from everything I'm reading, the Linux apps will work the same way. If you did get a virus, they'll all be sandboxed, so that one app may become infected, but that app can't infect anything else.
The whole machine isn't.
Right. Everybody plays in their own sandbox, mm-hmm. which is what sandboxing means. So we'll see. It's a pretty fascinating thing. I don't suspect they will run on low-end Chromebooks. I think you'll want a 4 gig, machine with, at a minimum, an i3, an Intel processor, mm-hmm. an Intel i-series processor. But, you know, those are pretty much out there now.
Yeah.
So we'll see. It should be a pretty good
very
deal.
Interesting to see what develops in this arena.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm very excited. We'll see. Mm-hmm. All right. To the phones. Our first caller is Jerry from Rochester, New York. Hi, Jerry. What's up?
Hi. My question to you is, my Dell computer died.
Yeah.
And I brought it somewhere to have them get my files and whatever off there.
Right.
Okay. And when they did do that, and the store is now closed, I had something on there that was called Flipshare Videos, and Flipshare has now closed down. But my videos and pictures, okay, were there. And when it came over, when they took over them to my little laptop, and I do have another desktop at home, they all came in as something that I had to go and find the original file and do this and do that. So everything, when Flipshare, when you take pictures and Flipshare comes in, it goes into the little folder they create by the software for November, December, January, February, what year, okay?
Right.
All those things in there, suddenly, they were there, but they said I couldn't open them unless I went to the original file that was created from. What? And I brought it back to them and asked them, but I got no answers, and they were closing, and they really didn't care.
Yeah,
it sounds like they're put in a different format, and what they're saying there is that you probably need the original program that they were coded in.
Well, they were. I don't have any other program. The little Flipshare camera has the software and program in it. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But everything was fine before they transferred it over to my laptop, and suddenly everything is. It's there, but you click it, and it says you can't see it or you can't open it.
Right, because they can move the product. In other words, you can use just like documents and photos and everything else. The one thing that, I don't care what company it is, when you copy something over, programs have to be reinstalled. They can't be copied. Because okay. When you install a program, it adds certain things into the registry and other little bits of information that it needs to know how to handle it.
And unfortunately, Flipshare was discontinued several years ago, so yeah. You can't get that program anymore.
No.
So you need to use a different program to view those files.
I can view the files. They were imported into file folders, but they don't tell you what date they were. Like I told you that they were brought in. Normally, you put the camera into the computer and the USB, and it copies it in there, and it gives you the month, the date, the down the line, 2010, 2019, 18, you know, 17, mm-hmm. 15, whatever. They bring you down the line. And that's what I lost. Now, what? And also, they're there, but they tell me I can't open them. But I can also find them in the ones they imported in about 3 file folders, but they don't tell me when they were.
Yeah, that's part of the metadata in the file. It's called the EXIF data, the extended information. So you need a program that can read that EXIF data.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if...
Nick and I are both looking for alternatives to view the Flipshare files without the Flipshare software because you can't get it anymore.
If I had a new computer right now and I took my Flipshare camera, I have 2 of them left, and put it in the USB, everything would be fine from there on, okay?
Right.
No, it wouldn't because you don't have the Flipshare software anymore.
No. The software comes from the Flipshare camera. It comes from the camera.
Well, then you should be able to reinstall it on the new computer.
It doesn't say install or not. The only thing you do is to stick the USB in any computer, whether it has it or not. and then suddenly it will install it in a new one.
Well, and, but that's not happening anymore.
No.
Right.
Because because the FlipShare company, they got bought by Cisco and killed, so it likely can't download the installer. So if the installer's not already in the camera, you cannot install it.
Right.
Because
what's happening most likely is when you're plugging that camera in, what it's doing is through the internet going up there and grabbing the installer so it can install the software. But since that program's gone defunct...
My question is, though, how can I get the month by month videos, month and year videos.
You need a program.
There, but it says I have to find the original file. Now, they were fine on my laptop.
All right, hold on a minute. We got to take a quick break.
Sure.
Stay on the line. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, Jerry from Rochester, and you. 20 minutes after the hour at Soundbites is member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Computer talk you can understand. More Sound Bites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Wright.
And at 25 minutes after the hour, we are Sound Bites, and we have Jerry from Rochester on the line. Are you still there?
Yes, I am.
All right, Steve has...
Yep. So basically what the issue is when a camera takes a picture, the date the picture was taken, the type of camera, all the settings about the camera are stored in something called the EXIF metadata. They're not in the picture itself. They're in a little side of the picture. So you need a program that can read that data.
Mm-hmm.
Are you using Windows?
Yes, I have Windows 7 still. I did not want Windows 10. I still don't.
If you right-click on one of the videos...
I'm an old-fashioned lady. Yeah.
If you right-click on one of the files and then choose Properties and then choose Details, you'll be able to see a lot of that EXIF data.
Okay. Including the dates.
Details.
Okay. Yeah, it looks at the camera, the f-stop, the exposure, any text that was taken, but should also give you the dates. And then... I'm going to post a link in a moment to a program that will read all of the extended EXIF data. There's a couple of free ones and a couple of pay ones.
Okay.
That will show you all of that extra data.
I'm lost now. Okay. If I go into what was on my laptop was fine. All the files in FlipShare were fine. When the guy transferred in from my dead Dell over. They were all wrecked.
No, the files are still fine. It's you don't have the FlipShare software anymore.
No, but they were all wrecked. They're gone.
That's a different problem. Are you saying the files are not in the folder?
They're there, but I can't open them.
Okay, that's what we're saying. Yes, you cannot open them because you don't have the software. But if you right-click on the file and choose Properties and then Details, you'll be able to see all the dates you were interested in.
Okay.
And then you need to use a different program to open those files.
What am I going to use?
As we were talking a little bit earlier, you can use a program called GIMP. There are...
GIMP?
Yep, GIMP, the GNU Image Manipulation Program.
That's a big program. What I might suggest you try first is EarFan Viewer.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. That way.
I'll spell it for you. IR, as in Richard... F as in Frank, A-N, View, EarFan View. It's all one word. It's at EarFanView.com, and Steve will post a link to that in just a minute.
I-R-F-A-Z-A, EarFaza?
EarFan.
Okay.
Like I as in Internet, R as in Richard, F as in Frank, A as in Apple, N as in Nicholas.
Okay.
View.
Okay. And Z-A?
V-I-E-W.
V-I. Ooh.
EarFan View.
V-I.
Yeah, the guy that wrote the viewer is called EarFan. That's his
name. Yeah, the guy's name is EarFan. And
okay. So I-R-F is in Frank. A. N is in whatever. Z-I-E-W.
You got it. EarFanView.com. We'll get you to that software. It's a free program. It runs on Windows 7. And it opens many, 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 many things. That's what I would try first.
Okay, so I'm looking for something to tell it to what? What am I going to call it when I go in there?
To open that
they
file.
They give you selections. What do I do then?
Well, what you want to do is after you install UrFan View, okay? Yes?
Yes. Ask.
No, after you install UrFan View. Install UrFan View first.
Yes.
Then go to any one of your pictures.
Okay.
Right click on it, and you'll see a menu pop up.
Mm-hmm.
One of the choices on that menu should be open with.
It'll say open. Oh, yeah. Okay, I know that. That's...
Yep, and then it'll give you a list of programs, one of which will be UrFan View.
And it's going to be UrFan View.
Right,
okay.
And so click on that, and it should open that. And then try it. If it works, then the next time you right-click and select open with, you'll also see a checkbox that says always use this program. But don't check that until you've tested it.
Okay, so this is going to open it with the date that I took it, right?
It's going to open the picture.
Yeah.
And as Steve said, the other program that he is going to post on our website will show you the EXIF data. Extended information file data.
There is a plug-in for UrFan View that will show you the EXIF data right in UrFan View.
Let's go one
step
at a time.
So you can do it in one program. But yeah, so you use one program to see the dates and everything that were taken in the picture, and a different program to view the picture.
All right. I think I'm all right. Okay.
Yeah, I think you've got it. It's really just because the FlipShare software isn't there anymore. You really need two programs to do what you want to do. One, the EXIF program, which Steve will post, will show you all the information that's inside the picture, including when it was taken.
Mm.
The other program, UrFan View, will let you actually view the picture.
Okay. UrFan View.
UrFanView.
IRFAN, okay. All right. So tell me, if I can't do this, can I bring this to somewhere to you guys and pay you to do this for me?
There are different shops in town that offer services like that, including my shop. We primarily specialize in Macintosh, but we also do Windows.
Okay.
And that's MacAv, and you can find our information on the Soundbites website.
Right, and you might find it easier to have someone install the software and show you how to use it, because if you've got hundreds of pictures and you ask somebody else...
I mostly have videos.
Right, but
you can click it and create a picture from it, you know. And
video?
I brought it back to the guy who transferred over from my dead Dell, my files, to my laptop. And my laptop pictures and everything, videos were fine.
Because you
and
have the software.
Suddenly they weren't, because whatever he transferred
right.
over.
No, it has nothing to do. Yeah, it's nothing
to
do with him.
It to somebody.
It's you don't have the software you need
on
the new computer.
You do need to take it to somebody and have them look at it.
But what did he do?
He didn't do anything to it.
The computer was fine. What did he do?
He didn't do anything to it. Programs cannot transfer from computer to computer. You must install them on the new computer.
As I said in the beginning of the discussion, you have to have the program. That's something that can't be dragged, click on it and say, all right, grab this program folder and drag it over to the new computer. You can't do it that way, because when you install software, when that program first installed, it added a lot of other stuff into the registry.
Uh-huh.
Okay? What you're trying to do now is when you plug that in, it's not being able to go up and get those other files that it needs.
Because the company is gone.
Because the company is gone.
That's not the fault of the person who moved the files
over.
Yeah,
they did nothing wrong. They did what you asked them to do, is to move this stuff over.
They did everything they could.
Oh,
yes.
I know he did that, but I don't understand why he killed the ones that were already on
my laptop. He did not kill anything.
He did not kill anything. Jerry, listen and pay attention.
Okay.
He did not kill anything. The problem is
Windows.
That because the software could not be installed,
mm-hmm.
it cannot view the pictures on your laptop.
All your pictures.
It's nobody's fault, right. And none of the files are ruined.
Right, they're all there.
It's just because of that software not being available any longer.
Okay.
They cannot be viewed exactly as they are.
Mm-hmm.
So if you take it to someone, also bring your FlipShare camera with you.
Oh, yeah, that makes a big difference. Yeah.
Take your FlipShare camera and have them take a look at it and see what could be done.
Okay. Do you recommend anybody that I can bring this to that can do this for me?
There are lots of reputable dealers, including MacAv and several others. We really don't recommend any one particular shop as all of them.
Okay, you said
MacAv.
Okay, I don't have a Mac. Okay.
Yeah.
As I said, we also handle Windows users.
I will have to bring it to them because.
Yeah.
Just because I got nothing here and I can't do this.
Sure, I understand. I do understand. Thank you, Jerry.
I used to be very good at this stuff, and no more.
Yeah, I get it. I get it.
And that's the problem with proprietary software and hardware. You want to make sure when you're taking your pictures to use a generic format like JPEG. Now, hundreds of programs can read JPEG formats. And so then you can use any JPEG viewer. You're not
stuck. I don't believe that FlipShare gave you that option. I think it was just do it the way we do it and we're done. All right,
you can
back
use Handbrake to convert it, though.
Right. Back to the phones. Our next caller is Ken from Rochester, New York. Hi, Ken. What's up?
Well, I'm calling you folks. I don't have a question.
Okay, thanks.
You guys need a pat on the back. You guys did a yeoman job, and you had the patience of Job trying to help that lady out. And, I sincerely mean that.
Well, thank you so much. She got confused, and I understand that. It's very hard to deal with that stuff.
I found an ancient FAQ on Cisco's website, and they still have the download link for the previous software.
So there you go. So she can...
No, it's there, and you can't download it. The link is there, but the file is gone.
Right, the file is gone. Thank you very much, Ken.
She wasn't in the studio. She might have kissed you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, Ken.
That's all I got.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, we're always happy to help anyone with whatever question they've got. She was certainly confused, and I get that.
Yeah, she was very confused because she knows enough to be... This is one of those folks, knows enough, but can be dangerous.
Well, not dangerous, just doesn't know. You don't have to know how to fix an engine to drive a car.
Right.
Similarly, you don't have to know the ins and outs of software in order to run a computer. But when something goes wrong, you now have to take it to somebody who can fix a motor or can fix a computer. But don't call her dangerous because she's just... It's not her thing.
Well,
I used to tell that to my students all the time. They would say, oh, that faculty member doesn't know anything about computers. They're stupid. That faculty member has 3 PhDs and has written 18 books. What they don't know is computers. So you can't call them stupid. All you can call them is not aware of what you are aware of when it comes to one thing.
Wait a minute. And let me clarify. What I mean by dangerous is by trying to take those files and perhaps destroy them or, trying to use other programs to open them up or that, to actually ruin them.
Well, because that's why we tell people always back up before you start playing around with
that. I don't think she did because the computer died.
Right.
And I'd hate to see her. It sounds like these folders are, in movies and all that, are very precious to her.
Right.
So that's why I don't want her to do something. It's just like we don't tell folks to go into the registry and play around with that. Because that is very dangerous. And, we don't want her to go doing something. That's why... The two programs you gave, it's going to be a little timely in doing some of this stuff.
Right.
But they're still going to be, there for her to use.
Right. Yep.
And I'd hate to see anything happen to it because I've seen this a number of years over the time in doing business for folks that they will go in there and they'll try something else and they go, I think I did this. I wish you had just brought it to me.
Right.
Because they did so many other things that they actually messed it up. Matter of fact, I had one client recently actually format his whole hard drive.
Oh, yeah. Well, what Jerry really needs to do is to bring it to a reputable dealer.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing that person should do, and she should tell them this and certainly pay for it, is back up all her files.
Yeah.
put them on a CD or a thumb drive or whatever, and get them all back
just
up
in case something else happens to them.
That's exactly
And in general, for everybody, when you buy software, keep the box, keep the disc, keep the license code.
Right.
When you download and buy software off the internet, print out the license code they email you. Keep that safe. We see it all the time with customers that bring in a dead computer and want the data put in the new one. Data transfer is fine. Applications, you need those disks. You need those license keys. If not, you got to pay for it again.
That's exactly
and hope
right.
the company is still
and
around.
The companies don't care.
Yeah.
We got to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, Mina Francesco, and you. It's 39 minutes after the hour. It's Soundbites. It's member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 44 minutes after the hour, we have Greg from... Nope. Do not want to talk to somebody who's got sunshine and clear skies and warm weather and ocean. No.
Tell us it's raining.
Tell us it's raining, Greg. Greg is from California.
Actually, it's May gray. 62 degrees and May gray, so...
Yep.
Oh, that's all right, then. We'll talk to you. How are you? What can we do for
I've
you?
I've got an issue with my MacBook Pro and Time Machine, which is a network machine backup. And the problem is that it continually goes to preparing backup and never gets past that. And I've tried a few things, but I really don't know what to do now.
Generally, what it does during that preparing stage is it looks at your backup file, compares it with your current machine, a current software, and figures out what needs to be backed up. So it's looking for the changed files. Sometimes things can get corrupted, and it can't find those changed files. I'm scanning for that link. There's a guy that has a really good... Time Machine troubleshooting page. You can try running the disk utility program on your backup drive. And that will try to repair any damage to the disk directory. And if that doesn't work, the usual fix is to delete the in-progress backup and let it start over again.
Well, that's the problem. I can't find in-progress file. I can't even find the sparse bundle. When I mount the... it's a Western Digital network drive, and all I see when I mount it is like a couple of directory public and OS X, and there's nothing in the OS X directory, so I'm kind of stuck on that.
Did it ever work?
Oh yeah, it worked for my 2000. This is a 2015 MacBook Pro Retina, and it also worked on my 2012 MacBook Pro. So it's been working fine for a lot.
There's supposed to be a folder called backups. On that.
Don't
volume,
see that.
And that's the folder it's backing up into.
Is it inside the OS X folder?
It should be at the root of the shared volume.
I don't see it. Maybe if I went in and hooked it up a different way, I don't know.
That may be. So if that folder's not there, it can't do a backup. So that could be the problem.
So if he creates that folder?
The Time Machine should create it for him. But if it thinks it's already there, it's going to keep looking for it.
Uninstall, reinstall?
No, it's an OS feature. A kind of drastic solution is to erase the drive and start over again.
Yeah, I thought about that, but then I lose everything I have.
Right.
Right.
And
can you see the old files?
No, I can't find that backup folder.
I can't find the backup folder at all. So,
how full is the drive?
Pardon?
How full is your backup drive?
Oh, it's got about, it's got almost half a terabyte on it.
Those files got to be somewhere.
Should be enough, yeah.
No, what I'm saying is it's not like the
drive that's
right, other stuff. Can you scan the drive for folder sizes?
Hold on. Before you do that, let me ask you a question.
Okay.
Is it possible that you in some way accidentally dragged the backup folder into another folder? So if you were to open all your other folders and just look at them, you might find the backup folder, which you should then drag back out to the root directory.
Or can he do a search on that drive to find out what folder it
or
might
search.
Be?
Yeah. The idea I'm thinking is if you've got half a terabyte in that drive already, then your files are there somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But either they're hidden,
or
which is to
them.
Say that the or you either you
that
drag
makes,
them
that
well,
makes sense.
They're hidden. Either either by dragging them somewhere into another folder, or by accidentally renaming the folder with a period in front of it.
Yeah, because period makes the Unix files invisible.
Right. So the first thing you should do, and can you can do a search, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yeah,
so he should do a search of that Western Digital external drive for a file called backup or backups.
I'm trying to find the exact syntax. It's a folder called backups.backupd, I think.
Well, but in fact, if he just searches for backup, shouldn't it find...
It should find them all, yeah.
Right. So if you just search for backup and search that drive, if that and that file's got to be there somewhere, because like I said, you got half a terabyte of data on there somewhere.
Wait, he just said something, though. Didn't you say it's backup dot something?
Mm-hmm.
If he accidentally highlighted the backup part...
Yeah, then it would just be
then
dot something.
Deleted, then it'd be dot something. So very well,
well
could be hidden.
I don't normally go in and do anything on that network drive.
No, I understand that.
Yeah,
and that's why I'm saying it would be an accident. But I'm just putting out all the possibilities.
Okay.
Whether whether that's what happened or not is
we're playing devil's advocate.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Yeah. The name of the folder is backups.backupdb.
Yeah. Okay. I will try that. I've tried searching from the Mac. I'm thinking maybe I should just try it from my Windows machine.
You may also have to turn on
hidden files.
Hidden files, yeah. In when you go into Find, there's an option to
hidden and system files. Okay, maybe that's what the problem is, hidden files.
Right. Mm-hmm. If the file is hidden, and again, that can happen by putting a period in front of the word backup, in front of the file name. It's still there. It's just hidden from a normal view of the directory. And what would have to happen is... you can view hidden files?
Yeah, you have to turn on hidden files and system files in the Find window. There's a menu where you can pick what criteria you're using.
So if you view hidden files, you may just see it right there. And all you have to do then is remove that period from the front of the name.
Okay. That sounds good.
Yeah.
Well, I'll give that. It goes back a long time.
Yeah.
Internet radio. It was internet radio, because we're a wasteland here in terms of, good jazz and that sort of stuff. So.
Right. Great. Well, we're delighted that you're a listener. Thank you very much.
Pass the word around.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Yep. Have fun. Yep. Temecula, California. Well, yeah.
I think we've
wine
had
country.
Callers from Temecula before, because I remember looking it up.
Yep. Yeah. That's right. So thank you. Thank you so much, Greg, for listening. I hope you're a member. Speaking of which, by the way, we're delighted. We should tell you about some of the cool things that are going on. Which, as you know, we are a member supported station, and we're coming up to the end of our fiscal year, so we've got a few things going on that are important to us. We've had, as you know, last week we had a couple of problems, so we'd like to end the year in the black. And so, if you're not a member, it's very easy to become a member. It's very easy to do. Just go to jazz901.org and click the donate now button. One of the best ways to do that is, of course, to become a Jazzomatic member, a minimum of $10 a month. And it's painless and easy, and we can have folks like Greg out in California listening to our stream. The stream is not cheap. Nothing in radio is cheap anymore.
There's a price tag to everything.
Right. The other thing to pay attention to is if you go to jazz901.org, you will also see all about the jazz cruises. If you like good music and you like boats and you like the canal, we're a triple threat here.
A great relaxing evening.
It's an amazingly relaxing evening, and you should check it out. You can buy tickets online. You can call the office at 966-2660 Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. And it's pretty cool. And there's also a Xerox Rochester International Jazz Festival contest going on.
We should mention the Jazz Cruise tickets are nearly sold out. So if you're interested,
get them right away because...
I think there's a couple of them already sold out.
Yes,
they're that popular, and I mean, if you've never done before, going through the locks and everything else, and just standing up on top of
not all lock cruises, but yeah, they're very, very cool. You can actually see some of the pictures about it, and you can click the donate now button. You can click if you scroll down, you can see about tickets for that. The Rochester International Jazz Festival thing, they're having a contest. And that's very cool. It's a two-night stay at the Hilton Garden Inn downtown. You and your significant other, or I suppose insignificant other, I don't really care, I'm not judging. You get the Hilton Garden Inn downtown, two nights there, dinner for two at Good Luck. Registration for that ends on June 3rd, so if you're doing it, do it quick. That's all going fast.
Yeah, because next month is the Jazz Festival.
Right.
Amazing how fast that snuck up on us.
Man, oh man. And it's going to be amazing. It's one of the great jazz festivals in the world, and it happens right here in this town.
Last year we made the top 10 places to go as far as festivals, jazz festivals.
You know, they say a prophet is never honored in his own country.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also true of the Eastman, an utterly amazing music school. And all we think of it is, oh, yeah, it's a school down on Main Street there. Who cares? But it's an amazing world-class music school. And consequently, there are an amazing number of world-class musicians in Rochester. And the International Jazz Festival is a world-class festival that happens here in town.
Matter of fact, I was glad to see this one group that I love. And I believe they've been coming, this will be now, I think, the 14th year. They've been coming here as long as just about as long as the Jazz Fest. They are one of the longest groups coming to the Jazz Fest, and the group I'm talking about is Soul Stew, and they're a group out of Toronto, and they come down, like I say, for the past 14 or 15 years, I forget which, and they play out on right there on the main drag,
right
on Gibb Street. And
Jazz Street is their name.
Yeah, the Jazz Street for the evening. But it's a free concert. There's a lot of them out there, folks. You can come down, have a great evening. It's a family thing that you can do with your family and not worry about, you know, anything. Yeah. I mean, it's usually
a family thing you can't do with your family.
Just let it ride. Just move on.
Well, what I'm talking about is if you go to some of these festivals, if there's drinking and everything else, some idiots don't know how to drink.
They don't know they shouldn't.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
They know how to drink too well.
But I have never seen a fight or any hassle break out in all
these. There are so many people. It's packed.
Yeah.
The streets are packed.
Yeah.
And if you get the chance, stop by the Jazz 90.1 booth out there on Jazz Street and say hi and maybe drop a buck in the barrel there.
I've always said, I've been saying it now, for the past, 7, 8 years, that, you know, if everybody that went to the Jazz Fest just dropped $1 into that bucket, we wouldn't have to have a fun drive.
That's exactly true.
Because there's over 200,000 folks.
That's exactly true.
Come to this jazz festival. And, you know, it's just, like I said again, I know I'm repeating myself. It's just a very relaxing, fun evening. You'll love it. You know, tell other folks. We get people from all around the world that plan vacations to come to it.
Right. That's exactly right. And it's an easy thing for a Rochesterian to do. It's a beautiful week of unbelievable, and it's not And, you know, it's the Rochester Jazz. It's a jazz festival. But, mm-hmm. in fact, there's country. There's soul. There's rock. There's everything is there. There's a
the big
got
tent.
The list.
Big tent. They've got a hip Hispanic all-stars, Moon Hooch, Johnny Goldtooth. Let's see. Where's one of the... I mean, Saxomatic. I mean, there's a lot of free concerts out there also. You know,
right, but
along
in terms
the big
of genre, it's pretty much everything.
Oh, it's...
All right, listen. That music tells me you've wasted an entire hour of your life with this nonsense. But we're going to let you have the opportunity to do it again. So we're going to take a short break. But we'll be back in just a few minutes with a whole nother hour of the longest running computer show in the known universe. That's right. You are listening to Sound Bites right here on the Truly Great. And truly grateful to you that we can continue to be member-supported Jazz 90.1. Go get yourself a beverage, take a little break, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes. See you on the other side.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more sound bites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
WGMC Greece Rochester. A public service of the Greece Central School District. Jazz 90.1.
Online at jazz901.org.
Welcome back to America's longest-running computer show, Sound Bites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And 5 minutes after the hour, we are Sound Bites. And, Apple iPhone and iPad users, take note. A vulnerability that might affect tens of millions of users leaves devices open to dangerous attacks. The flaw, dubbed Zipper Down, resides in almost 16,000 iOS apps that have been downloaded 100 million times. An unknown number of apps on Google's operating system were also affected. Little is known about the bug right now, other than that it is a very typical programming error. The worst case scenario, it depends on the affected app and its privileges. In general, attackers could overwrite the affected app's data and even gain code execution in the context of the affected app. Notice that the sandbox on both iOS and Android can effectively limit ZipperDown's consequence. When we talk about viruses in a computer, particularly a Windows computer, once you're in, you pretty much own everything. But on iOS and on Android and on Chrome and on Linux and on the Mac OS, when you gain access, you are often limited by what the level of access is allowed to do. At any rate, translate that. It means that the attack probably wouldn't be catastrophic, as Apple and Google limit what data on the smartphone is accessible to a hacker who exploits a single app. Such hacks should be contained to just the information controlled by that application. There is a reason for some concern, despite the limitations of ZipperDown. It's more of an unexpected way in rather than a complete exploit for iPhones. The apps could be abused by a hacker sitting on the same network as the target, such as an attacker who has access to ISP infrastructure or is on the same Wi-Fi network in, say, a coffee shop. But if you're on a public Wi-Fi network or even a bugged private network, then it is a risk for that as well by manipulating an ongoing download with content crafted in a specific manner, which could do more damage. An app update can fix it pretty easily. So if you're an iPhone, iPad, or Android user, keep those applications up to date to avoid any complications should real-world hackers get hold of the exploits. What's happened is Apple and Google have removed most of the infected apps from their stores, or they've been updated and verified by Apple and Google to be clean. So make sure you are updated with the latest version. If you've been not updating because it's annoying or takes too long or whatever. Now's the time to do it. So are you worried about your iDevices security? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299 or toll free at 1-800-790-0415. We see, I don't know how to put this best. We see that as time rolls on, particularly older apps that may not get an update can be infected. And when they are infected, there's a problem in that people are just continuing to run them. They're not being updated. Nobody's looking at them. That's why Apple is now talking about removing all 32-bit apps from their store, because the 32-bit apps are the old ones.
And every now and then, there was a story last year that every now and then Apple will purge apps that haven't been updated in years.
Right, and so
although, unfortunately, we had a customer come in this morning with an iPhone 3G from 2008 that wanted to give it to her niece. And the phone itself will probably work, because at least it's 3G. But you can't get anything out of the App Store anymore that supports a 10-year-old phone.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it's an issue. And both Apple and Google are very good about wandering around through their own stores, obviously electronically, looking for problems, doing essentially a virus check of all of their apps. But there are millions and millions and millions of those apps. So those checks take time. They'll eventually hit them all, but that will take time. So your best bet is to be proactive. Make sure all your apps are up to date with the absolute latest versions. If you've got an app that's very old, and particularly if it's an old app that you simply don't use anymore, dump it. A, it frees up space on your phone for other stuff, and B, it may clean up an infection. So be a little aware and a little proactive about how you handle the data and stuff on your phone.
And I can understand when folks say, well, you know, I still need that app. Well, you know what? Not enough folks out there did. So that's why
Right. And
they didn't pay for the app, or they just stayed with the free version instead of, you know, stepping it up. And if they were using it that much, pay for the paid version to keep the programmer interested in updating that app, because, be quite honestly, I'm not going to waste my time as a programmer to update this app and nobody's paying me for it after so many years, and I've got something else that people really like, and I'm, you know, updating that constantly because folks are supporting me.
And how many apps have you downloaded that, oh, that's neat, oh, that's neat, oh, that's neat, and haven't touched them in years?
Yeah.
Right.
So that'll help clean some space off your phone, too, that you probably are running out of.
Well, that's exactly right.
It may not be a lot of space per app. You know, you look at your phone space, and it's almost always your pictures that are taking all the space.
Yeah.
But if you've got 50 apps that are taking, you know, 50 megs apiece, you know, that's not a single big app. But that's a lot when you add it all up together.
Yeah. That's a lot of space. People are always complaining they don't have enough space in their phone. And I will say to them, what apps aren't you using? Oh, I need them all. I bet you don't.
Mm-hmm.
I bet you've got apps that you haven't run in a year.
Or better. Or what'll happen is it's not in their screen. You know, it's one of the screens they swipe.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But yet if you go into the list of all the apps that you could move out to a screen, that's usually a longer list. And that's the one that you should go through and really think about. Maybe I can drag it up and uninstall it. If I really need it that bad, I'll get the newest version.
Right.
You know, because just seeing it not there on the screen doesn't mean that your phone is still getting loaded up, because it's not on the screen, but it's still there in the phone.
And every now and then, do a security check. Go into your security preferences and see what apps you've allowed access to your location, allowed access to your camera, allowed access to your pictures, you know. You might have forgotten something that you had back then that you allowed access to, say, your pictures, and you haven't used it in years. It still has access to your pictures.
Yeah,
that's exactly right. So be very aware and cull out the junk from your computer. It's not in your phone. It's not good. It's not secure. if you haven't looked at it in a while and don't know what's on your phone. I'm always talking to people all the time, and they start swiping through their phone. They go, oh, I forgot I had that.
Yep.
Okay, probably time to uninstall it then. Well, I might need it someday. Then download it again and install it. How easy is that?
Those apps only take seconds to download anyway.
That's exactly.
And you're probably getting a newer version than the one you had that you downloaded a year ago.
Right. Yep. And like we just said, who knows what you gave it in terms of access and everything else. So definitely be very careful.
Apple has a feature, and I assume Android probably does also, that if you don't use an app for a while, it will remove the file from your computer but save the fact that you have it, so that if you do then want to go back to it, on the Apple there's a little cloud icon, so you can re-download that app.
Right.
But then it removes the space, so you don't take up that space on your phone. So remember when 8-gig phones were huge? And now, you know, my 32-gig iPad is nearly full all the time. I had to get a 64-gig phone because it's nearly full all the time.
Yeah. Well, I had the same problem with my little my iPod. Remember, I got that burner phone. And I tried to download another app the other day, and it wouldn't download. I said, What do you mean it wouldn't download? Oh, right, it's only an 8-gig phone. That's right. I forgot that.
Oops.
That's right. I almost forgot that. And my phone, the nice thing about the phone that I have is that I can throw in a micro SD card.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got, it's only 64 gig, but
it
takes all my music and everything else. So none of that is taking up the main space in my phone.
Right. You can swap those out, too.
And I can swap those out if I want to. So, and you can move, on a lot of them, you can actually move the app data over to those as well so that that takes up less space. And I don't think that particularly the newer iPhones don't give you that choice. You can't throw an SD card in there.
It's not built in, but there's some third-party SD cards that allow you to transfer, mostly photos and video, because that takes up the most space.
Right. Yeah. And I've got, that's what I'm mostly using,
yep,
the extra card over. You just go in and you say, I want you to save pictures to the SD card. And you're done. I uploaded a little app the other day that does voice recording. And again, I went in there and I said, no, save it to the SD card.
Because it could fill up the internal memory.
That's exactly right.
Very fast.
And then, of course, you can, Bluetooth it over to your phone and delete it or whatever you're going to do. So, Bluetooth it over to your computer. Although Bluetooth is slow. but, it was actually faster, believe it or not, to upload it to Google Drive and then download it to my desktop than it was to Bluetooth it over.
Nope.
Bluetooth is not fast. It's not designed to be fast.
Yeah, no, it's not. It's reliable, but...
It's reliable, but it's not fast. But it does, the fact that I can, in fact, do that, Bluetooth a file from my phone to my computer and then complain that it's too slow, there's a first world problem for you.
Yeah, and I still think back when we started talking phones to my very first phone, which was a brick.
Yep.
Right.
Literally, they called it, the brick.
Right. And of course, we all remember the joy of flip phones.
Oh,
yep. Well, those were good because you flip them open and you're talking.
Yeah.
You flip them closed and you're done. You're finished.
I still know a number of folks that still have them.
Flip phones are coming back, but they're going to be different. What we're seeing in the labs right now are foldable screens.
Okay.
So a couple of concept phones have come out where it's a phone with a screen on the front, but you open it and it's a giant screen on the inside. Twice the size, right? So if you just leave it closed, you can make a call. You can, you can do all the stuff you do with a phone now.
Right. Yep.
But if you open it up, you get a much bigger screen for video or for, whatever it is you're going to do. But you'll have that now. So you'll be able to finally get back to where when you were angry with somebody, you slammed your flip phone closed. It was at least a little bit more satisfying than just punching and call.
Yep.
Nothing beats slamming the receiver down.
Yeah.
I like the communication devices they have on the Andromeda TV series, where they just pull the
yes
the flexible screen out. So you carry just a little roll of, you know, like a roll of coins or something,
right?
And the screen pulls out. You pull out as far as you want it.
Right.
So if you're reading a message, you pull a little bit. You know, when they're doing a space map, they pull out a lot.
Right. And I've seen that right as a concept phone as well.
Yeah.
And obviously, right now at least, that's very expensive. It's Corning is one of the major people back in the day with glass in the windows, but not all the windows because it was very expensive. But yeah, so there's a whole. There's a whole new world coming in terms of that stuff.
I was just chatting with a customer that worked at Corning, and at the Corning Museum they have this giant spool of fiber to show how, you know, fiber works, and this little tiny spool of fiber, I think it was like a mile long, and you shine the light in one end and it comes out the other end instantly, and it's really cool. And then right next to that is this giant copper wire that shows you this. So this one tiny fiber can do this one giant copper. Well, that's been there for 20 years. So if we tried to replace that now with what the fiber can handle, we would need a new building in copper wire
right.
to show what the fiber replaces.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes, Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Franceschi, 19 minutes after the hour. Soundwave, some member supported Jazz 90.1.
Computer talk you can understand. More Sound Bites is next on member supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm David.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 24 minutes after the hour, I'm all choked up. Excuse me. I beg your pardon. We are Sound Bites.
It looked like during the commercial, it looked like we were praying. We both had our heads down.
Please, Lord, let this be over. No. We're going to go back to the phones. Our next caller is Mark from Greece, New York. Hi, Mark. What's up?
Hi, guys. How's the day going for you?
Peachy, you?
Oh, it's going good. Remember a few weeks ago we talked about changing Firefox's place that it cached on my SD drive to the mechanical drive?
Vaguely, yes.
Yeah. Well, I changed that. Then you guys got me thinking, so I've been over the past few weeks doing some research, and I realized that they also suggest that I change where my virtual memory caches to.
Right.
So I figured out how to do that and put that over to the mechanical drive, which wasn't too hard, but they said it was very important that it not keep caching to the solid-state drive.
Right. Yeah, here's the deal with drives, with solid-state drives, and this is true of thumb drives and pretty much everything. If reading from them you can do all day, writing to them wears them out.
Literally and physically damaging the cell.
Right, yep. Damages the cell. So,
killing SSDs, prematurely aging them,
right.
By writing, you know, gigabytes an hour in one guy's case. He reads a gigabyte an hour? Sure. So you know, that could be 20, 30 gigabytes a day of writing and prematurely wearing out the SSD over time.
Right.
So we want it to be fast, but don't wear it out.
Right.
Now I read in an article, and I'm not sure if it's true, but they said in the article that these drives are meant to handle writing 50 gigabytes a day would be normal.
It depends on the drive and right. The level of drive. You get a consumer drive, no. You get an enterprise drive for 10 times the price, probably.
And right. They say the bigger the drive, the capacity, the better the drive is?
Well, no. Well, here's the deal with that. When you buy any SSD drive, they lie to you. So if you buy a 512 gig drive, it probably has 600 gig. But some of that is held in reserve. And as cells die, it essentially swaps them out for one of the reserve ones. Which means your drive now lasts longer than it would have because of that ability to swap out dead cells for reserve cells.
And sometimes they market the drive lower. It says 240, but it's probably 250, 260 to give that,
right.
that slack space.
Right.
Right. Now, the other concern is I don't use Chrome as much as I do Firefox, just my preference.
Sure.
And but I do use Chrome at points in time, and when I do, I use it for a while. I can't quite figure out how to change where that caching is done.
Oh, changing the cache in the Chrome browser.
Yeah, it's not as simple as it is in Firefox. What I actually did is just went into about config, put in that it says to put in the right value for where you want it to go, and I just totally changed it to my mechanical drive. And I didn't have to change the size or anything, you know, because I just put it on that mechanical drive. But I can't quite figure out how to do that in Chrome.
Right, right. Well, that, well.
The command line.
Right. The official way to do it is to use the command line.
Okay.
Or add it to your shortcut.
Right. So what you do is you add, for example, well, Steve can put up a link. But basically there's a --, disk cache dir and disk cache size that you add after the command that starts up Chrome, and then you say disk cache dir equals --/ something whatever, and or --, disk cache size equals whatever size you want it to be, and that's the way that seems to be working right now, at least in Chrome. Although they're changing this, they're changing it all the time. Particularly now that, Chromebooks are all solid-state drives, right?
Right.
So they fully understand the need to deal with that as an issue.
Okay. So you said Steve will put up a
Steve's going to put up a link. He's doing it even as we speak.
Okay. Awesome.
Yeah.
That's great.
Give him a minute. Like give him a minute, and then it should be there.
Oh, sure. No problem. And like I said, people that are using these solid-state drives, do change where your virtual memory is.
Yeah, go into Windows and change that. Change all the caches that you can. Those will, assuming you have a second drive. Now, for example, I've got a laptop that has only a solid-state drive. Well, I'm kind of done there.
Right, right.
You may want to reduce the size of your cache.
Right.
So it doesn't eat as much. So the whole point of cache is that it doesn't have to download the file because it's already there on your computer. But with internet speeds as fast as they are, it's probably faster to download it than it is to look in the cache.
Yeah, right. and so you can fairly easily do those things. Changing the cache on your machine is a little bit harder, but can be equally or even more important, depending on how, you know, if you've got a lot of RAM. Now, at my home machine, I've got 16 gig of RAM. I never use the cache ever. But if you've got 4 gig, you're probably using it regularly. 8 gig, you're using it some.
I'm almost regretting doing the full solid state drive, and maybe I should have done a hybrid drive.
That sometimes is a better deal, assuming that you buy a hybrid drive that gives you the option of putting things where you want them.
Right.
And not all of them do.
Yeah,
so,
most of them put the most common files on the SSD half,
right.
And your caches would be the common files.
Right.
Right.
So you need to turn off the learner, the AI thing that decides where stuff goes automatically.
Another thing I had to do is the trim wasn't turned on this SSD either.
We have to be a little careful with trim because sometimes between the drive and the OS, it may not be supported.
Right.
Yeah, it was supported but was turned off.
Yeah.
And I turned it on and the theory is that it's supposed to extend the life of the drive.
Ish, yeah.
So, but that's neither here nor there.
Okay.
Right.
So, well, thanks for the information. I'll look for that link.
Yep, thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, basically trim is the feature that helps the drive find a cell that has worn out and remap it to somewhere else and trim it out of use.
Right.
The drives will do that by themselves when they find that block that needs to be done. But what the trim command can do is scan the entire drive and find those blocks. In fact, that's one of the magic features of SpinRite. It still works on SSDs, even though it was designed 30 years ago for MFM spinning drives.
Right.
It works on an SSD because one of the things it does is tell the drive to look at every single block.
Yep.
And if the drive has trouble reading a block, the built-in technology says, well, okay, I better move that to another cell. And so that makes the block much more readable.
Right.
And also why SpinRite is so darn slow, because it has to read every single block.
Right.
And so that in the next version, he's really ramped up the speed. So now it should be able to do about a terabyte an hour.
That's kind of amazing.
Instead of a terabyte a week.
Well, of course, that's exactly right, actually. And of course, he hand codes in assembler.
Hand coded assembler.
So it is the smallest and fastest it can possibly be.
He was so mad when it went to 64K in one byte. Because then he had to go to 65K.
Right, he was very upset about that. Across the boundary. He didn't like it. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Dave from Canandaigua, New York. Hiya, Dave. What's up?
Oh, well, I think there's probably a Chromebook in my near future.
Don't sound so bad about that. It's a great thing.
Well, it looks pretty interesting. I've kind of ignored it and scoffed at it and whatever because I'm a CAD guy, you know, big desktop systems and all that.
Sure.
I'm going to be moving. I'm going to be on the road and living in an apartment or I don't know where I'm going to be living. So anyway, I can't actually bring LastPass with me on my iPad 3 because I can't upgrade to iOS 10, and LastPass won't run on anything under iOS 10. So,
right.
Yeah, I'll make the plunge. Anyway, I was wondering if there's a good place around town to go and sort of manhandle a Chromebook.
There are several places in town that sell them. The big box stores in particular generally have a few Chromebooks around. Not as many as you might like, but they do have a few around. That's what I did when I bought mine. I went and looked at about a half a day. And then because it's polite, I actually bought from them as well. But you can manage to check out. Chromebooks are not as the big thing about Chromebooks is really the screen, the size of the screen. As I get older, my original 11-inch Chromebook is not as much my friend as it used to be.
Yeah,
I have a 13-inch Chromebook and a 14-inch Chromebook. And I find myself happier with the 14 than even with the 13, although the 13 is much lighter.
Yeah, what's in the stores may or may not be the hardware that I really need. So the other thing I'm looking at would be if I were to install Chrome OS in a virtual machine,
mm-hmm.
would I basically have the true equivalent of a Chromebook?
About 99% of it.
Right.
There's a company called Neverware.
Okay.
Neverware.
Yep.
And they have a product called Cloud Ready. And it essentially is Chrome OS. And you can install it as a virtual device, or if you've got an old laptop, you can just put it on that.
Okay.
If you do a search through our archives, it's
about once a year we've
Pretty much once a year.
We mention it often, more often.
We mention it a lot more often. But you'll be able to find a link to it. It's at neverware.com, I think. And I've got it currently on an old laptop and as a VM because I'm constantly testing the new versions and playing around with it. And it works just fine. And although it is not really a Chromebook, you can't tell the difference.
Well, I just want to see from the software side that I have what I'm really jumping into, and this is looks like a good way to do it without plunking down several $100.
Right. It's a great way to start and to see what it can do. Now, be aware that one of the things it doesn't do yet, is some of the very newest stuff like run Android apps. Of course, as I said at the top of the show, Google has said by the end of this year, you'll be able to run Linux apps.
Right, which means that I'll be able to run Firefox on a Chromebook.
Yes, you'll be able to run anything you want on a Chromebook, right? I'll be finally be able for our friends who join us in Second Life every week. I'll be able to run Second Life on my Chromebook. That's very exciting to me. Sorry. But, yeah, and that will all be available to you in the newer versions of Chromebooks. You'll want, I suspect you'll want a minimum of 4 gig of RAM and an i3 processor at a minimum. But you'll be able to do all of that stuff. And, of course, if you're going to run Android apps, you probably want to have a screen that's touch-sensitive, right?
Yeah, that's kind of what I've been looking at. It's a pretty bewildering array of stuff there. But
Well, that's both good and bad. It's the freedom of freedom, right?
Right. I can buy what I actually need, not what the market offers.
Right, exactly. Exactly. It's a bewildering array, but once you pare it down, you get what you want rather than what they're selling.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Well, that'll probably do for now, I guess.
All right. Well, let us know what you think of Cloud Ready, and how you like the idea of. And I'll tell you what, I can do 99.999% of everything I ever want to do in my life on that Chromebook. Some things are a little easier when I'm sitting down at a giant screen, 16 gig of RAM, 8 core processor, but it's not that I can't do the things.
Yeah, I see. Mention of, like, you know, doing design work on your iPhone, and I just sort of chuckle.
But. Yeah, well, yes, you can, sure.
Right.
You're stuck in a line somewhere.
Right.
Yeah, the DMV isn't annoying enough.
Right.
No offense to our DMV employee, no.
All right, thanks, Dave. We got to take a break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It's 39 minutes after the hour. We are Soundbites, and we are right here in the truly great and grateful to you that we are member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Computer problems? Get answers from the experts. Soundbites, noon to 2 Saturdays, only on Jazz 90.1.
Maybe we should listen.
Maybe we should.
That sounds
like a good
show.
We might learn something. You never know. Anyway, welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 44 minutes after the hour, hey, wait a minute, we are Soundbites.
Huh?
Unbelievable.
Really?
We apparently are doing a radio show.
Oh.
For a couple of decades.
I thought I was just pushing buttons.
Almost 3 decades.
I was getting pretty good at moving these buttons up and down and around.
Yeah, you think so. Well, back to the phones. Our next
call. Hey, I haven't seen anybody. Rob jumping in here to do
it. That's right. Exactly right. We're back to the phones. Our next caller is Edward from Rochester, New York. Hi, Edward. What's up?
Yeah, on your earlier point about having old applications in your phone, some of them, unfortunately, as I understand it, are built in. And like Google, for example, they've got things like, things I never use, like Drive and music and movies,
right,
that just sort of sit there. And you can only, the way they've got a structure, either stop it or disable it. And my question is, if you can't uninstall something, that's not going to give you any more space, is it?
No, it isn't. And that's very true. Google does put some things in it, mostly their own apps.
But not much.
But then every phone company, Samsung adds their own apps, and LG adds their own apps. And then it goes to the carrier, and they add apps. So by the time you actually get your phone, half of it is filled with junk you don't want, and some of it is uninstallable.
Except the Google Pixel.
The Google phone.
When I got my Google Pixel phone, it was literally just the Google browser and the email program. Anything else that I wanted on that phone, I had to download and put it in there. Loved it.
Yep.
And that also is a problem with patches and updates. You know, Google releases a patch for Android. It has got to go through that same, you know, laborious process before the end users get it. In fact, I was just mentioning, I just got an old Samsung Galaxy S3 for my Rocket, and it's running Android 4, and I can't find a way to upgrade it yet.
And you probably never will.
Yeah. But so Google is working on a way to separate the OS from the front end, so that you'll be able to upgrade your OS without waiting for the handset and the carrier to get their fingers in it too.
Right. Just so Dave's Pixel phone was an automatic update from Google. Anytime there was an update, he got it instantly.
Oh yeah. I love it. It does it at night.
Well, of course.
And I never set
up to do that.
I never set any timers, but it knows my, because of my time zone. And I wake up in the morning and says,
"Well, what they normally do is they have a setting where it says update only while charging."
Yeah, right. I've got that. Yep.
So when you charge it, it'll do the update. And since you normally charge it at night while you're sleeping, that's when the update's.
And I love it because you just, wait a minute. I got to because it gives me a message. You need to restart your phone because we did an update. Yep. Oh, okay.
Yep.
Quick restart.
At any rate, Edward, the basic point here is you're absolutely right. Particularly on phones that have so much bloatware, as we call it, in them. Much of it you cannot remove, and in some phones you have a significant portion of your phone taken up with junk you don't really care about,
like Facebook,
and especially on the the 8 gig and even some of the 16 gig phones. You'll find that almost half the storage is the bloatware, and leaving you very little storage left for your own stuff.
Right.
So when you're looking to buy a phone, get more storage than you think you need because you'll need it.
Because you'll need it. And if you can, if you're looking at Android phones, you really want to go with a Pixel if you can afford it. They're not cheap. But if you can afford it, go with a Pixel. The OnePlus looks nice, but it's not on Verizon.
And that's the other problem, too. Some phones are only come with some carriers, not all carriers.
Right.
Yeah, you know, I'd always, in the past, be looking for other phones, you know, when a new one comes out, maybe upgrading that. Since I've gotten the Pixel, and that's been a couple of years now, it does everything I want. It takes phenomenal pictures, and it didn't come, like you said, with all that darn bloatware. I really don't need to switch to another phone.
But my other question would be, though, along with that, if you stop it or disable it, does that speed it up?
It speeds it up a little in that your system is no longer looking at it to do anything, but it doesn't remove it from your phone.
Taking up space.
One other thing you can do is go into the phone and on any device and any app that you have stopped, you can go in and make sure that the cache has been emptied.
I got you. Okay, that would help, yeah.
Yeah, that may save a little bit.
Somebody said if you get about 120... you got anything above 100, just clear it out, just habitually. Is that a good?
That's not a bad idea. I mean, it'll fill up again.
Yeah.
You know, depending. I don't bother to do it to the apps I use every day because why bother? But you're right. For apps you don't use regularly, clearing out the cache will save you some space.
Good. Okay. Well, that's a good point. Okay, I'll try that. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Yeah. It's Google's Pixel 2. The Pixel 2 XL, 128 gig or 200.
What's the Pixel Pixel XL going for too now?
I
think it's over $1,000.
Yeah, it's
if you max everything
$40
out,
a month
from
Verizon.
Right? Yeah, and that cell phone plans have switched over and they're strange now. So it used to be you would buy a plan with your phone. And so the phones would cost $2,000 or $3,000, but you'd get them for a couple hundred a month on contract. Well, now as they're not contract anymore,
right? They did away with the 2-year contract.
Right. It's a lease to own.
Right.
So you can either pay for it outright, and the premium phones are in the $700 to $1,000 range, or most companies now are offering a monthly payment. And you still end up needing a credit check because they're in essence giving you a $1,000 phone and you're promising to pay $100 a month until it's paid off.
Right.
So it's still $100 a month to you, but it's now not a contract anymore. It's a lease.
Right.
So
right.
Some accountant was involved there.
Or you can buy it. And you were asking what the Google Pixel XL, if you go the highest end with the most storage and blah, 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 it's about $1,400.
Yeah.
Yeah, no kidding.
And so get the extended warranty.
Yeah, you want the extended warranty for this.
And the other nice thing that a lot of companies, in fact, most of the companies have done now is they've separated the cost of the phone from the cost of the service. So under the old 2-year contract plan, you know, you'd pay $200 a month for your phone. At the end of 2 years, if you didn't turn in your phone, you have now paid off the phone, but you're still paying $200 a month, which means your service charges have doubled in essence.
Right.
Because your phone, your payment should go down because you've paid off the phone.
Right.
They never did under contract. Now, when you pay off your phone, if you decide to keep your phone, your bill goes down because you've paid the phone. Now you're only paying for service.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the companies will sell it that way too. It's $50 a month for the phone and $50 a month ish for the service.
Right. Right. So you can upgrade, and there are phone plans that say, you know, you upgrade every year or every 2 years. We just give you a new phone.
Yep.
But now you're paying constantly.
Yeah.
For that. And
you they know, always say,
and on one hand you say, well, it's $40 a month.
Yeah, you can trade in your old phone. We'll give you up to $400 for your old phone if you bought it yesterday.
Right.
If it's the one you bought 2 or 3 years ago, we'll give you $50.
Yeah, I taught my daughter long ago to listen for the weasel words.
Yep.
Up to are weasel words. The new OnePlus 6 looks amazing, but unfortunately it's not available on Verizon. So that's too bad. But yeah, the new phones coming out all the time. Everybody wants, the problem is everybody wants the high-end phones now,
mm-hmm.
right? Nobody wants that basic, essentially a flip phone without the flip. everybody wants it to do everything all at once, but nobody wants to pay any money for it. We'll see if OnePlus 6, which has some very high-end design features at a mid-range price, we'll see if that, you know, moves the market in any way, shape, or form. Now, the problem, of course, has always been Apple. Their phones are not inexpensive.
Right.
And people have been willing to pay that amount of money, although Apple is now saying that the next phones will be less expensive.
Well, and they have always, for years, sold, you know, last year's phone for cheaper.
Right.
And 2 years ago phone for even cheaper.
Right.
So we kind of joke a little bit about it that you can buy an iPhone for $329 now. That's their entry-level phone. It's 3 years old, but right. it's only $329 and does pretty much what everyone wants the phone for, just doesn't have all the latest whiz-bang features.
Right. Well, and that's the other thing, of course, is you know, I never have even really thought about changing my phone, except like the other day we were out with family and I wanted to take a picture and I really couldn't because it was a very low light place.
Yeah.
Only the people with the iPhones could take pictures. The new iPhones.
Yeah.
Could take pictures.
Low lights always a
right, trick. Right. And that's the only time that I think to myself, well, you know, it would be nice. But it is what it is and oh well, I guess. It's a long time between phones for me. I can't hear you.
You're too far away.
Oh, sorry. I just don't have any interest in switching.
What was he saying earlier about knowing how the sliders work?
Yeah.
Well, I'm trying to do...
He knows how the sliders work. It's the big thing on the end of the pole that he has trouble with.
The slider was down, too.
And the game was potted down as well. Yeah.
Well, because I'm getting ready to
close.
Yeah. We've heard that before.
Have they decided what P is going to be yet?
That I've heard, no.
Pumpkin pie seems to be the one I'm hearing around, bandied about.
It's got to
be dessert, so we're looking desserts that start with the letter P.
Right. All right, that music tells me... okay, I get it. There's the music. Now I hear it. That music, which you probably can't hear, tells me that we're done for another week. I want to thank Dave Enright. I don't know why. I want to thank Steve Ray. I'm Nick Francesco. Don't go away. George is coming in to play the best German music you'll hear all week. Michael's here to keep him on the straight and narrow. And we will be back next week with a whole lot more of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. That's right. You're listening to Soundbites and the Truly Great. And as always, truly grateful to you that you allow us to be member-supported Jazz 90.1. We will see you in 166 hours.